It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go. We are off and running for another broadcast evening, this one being the 12th day of April, 2018. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where we live, and that is where you go if you'd like to be part of the Madcap Merry Multimedia Zany Wacky real-time extravaganza that is The Horn chat room. Yes, just pop on by, pick yourself out a screen name and a password, log in. And you'll be immediately greeted by the likes of Foam Cups and Hogs and Hoghead and Squeaky and VT Blom, and moderated, of course, by longtime inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a spacing guild master, can no longer fold space in this particular chat room. Also moderated by midweek pinch hit utility chat room moderator and all around great guy Steve from Georgistan. Hail, hail, the gang's all here, and what the hell is that, a baby hippopotamus or something? Something is repeatedly, weird stuff going on. And like I said, it's a madcap multimedia zany wacky real-time extravaganza. I wouldn't say that if it were not true. Hey, there's Ralphs wandering in. Good evening, Ralphs. All kinds of good fun times. There's Squeaky. I think we got it. We're moving toward having a pretty darn good group this week, or this evening in the chat room. We have one most every night. This is the fourth night of unscheduled broadcasting. You might recall I was supposed to be in Washington D.C., but I suffered a bit of molar time. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It's Thorn in the Side Thursday. And the first thing we do at the beginning of every broadcast is thank our subscribers, who are, in fact, partial sponsors of the program. And as a result, thanks go out to Christopher, and thanks go out to Angelica in Oregon. Thank you so very, very kindly. Thank you very much. To Paul out in California. Thank you, Paul. Thanks very much to Mark in Minnesota. And thanks very much indeed to Gary up in New York. Thank you, one and all, for your subscriptions. You help knock down about a quarter of the fundraising for this program every single month. And I know you'd like to have more company. And if you'd like to become a subscriber, well, just run on over to HeadOn.live. Scroll down till you see the PayPal button. Click on the PayPal button. Click that little box that says "Make this a recurring whatever or whatever." Put in the $10 and click it and forget it. And then this day of the month, every month, it'll all your contribution that works out to about less than 50 cents for every program, cheaper even than iTunes, will come out. If you want to have it all come out on the first day of the month instead, then by all means, use the Patreon button, also at HeadOn.live, The Patreon campaign is for people who hate PayPal. And as a consequence, those come out, like I said, on the first of the month. Thanks also going out to Charlene. Thank you very kindly, Charlene in Rhode Island, for jumping in earlier today, about an hour or so ago. That takes the remaining fundraising for the week down to $221. $221 to go. Thank you, Charlene. Thank you so very much. It would be great. It's been coming down really, really, really slowly, but it would be great if we could wipe that out this evening. $221 to go. Not $1,221, just $221 to go. And we'll be finished with fundraising for the week. That leaves us next week, and then we've got fundraising free broadcasting. Wouldn't that be cool? Yes. So head on over to headon.live, use the PayPal button. Of course, if you want to mail it in, so to speak, the mailing address is also at headon.live. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. And I need to send out thanks again to our buddy Texas T. It took a couple of phone calls because of translations into the original South Alabama dialect, but this tooth being what it is, it's had to be cut up into very, very small pieces. It's been a beautiful thing to smell the hickory-smoked wonderfulness of Kaneka sausage wafting through the house. Oh, it's good, I tell you, it's good. Kaneka, if you want to try it yourself, Kaneka sausage, Koneckuh sausage, Sausage, KanekaSausage.com. It is beyond compare. Just yummy. A continuing update, the problems with the White Rose server persist. Ben is still plugging away at it, and I'll let you know when it gets back to normal. Right now, everything is going through headon.live. If you want to listen via TuneIn, remember, search The Horn, THEHORN, and look for the Horn logo, and that's a TuneIn stream based on the headon.live bulletproof stream. As Steve from Georgia Stan calls it. Is that everything? Is that all the shilly-shallying that comes at the front of the program? I think so. I'm told that we are running fast, true, and hot on headon.live, so that's a positive. That's a plus. It's great when things work. Yes. Where to begin this Thorn in the Side Thursday? I'm gonna return to something I was talking about toward the end of the program last night, if you don't mind. And that is this very, very interesting article by right-wing blatherskite Eric Erickson. It's titled "A Congressman's Profanity-Laced Tirade in a Safeway Grocery Store." In a way, it reminded me. What was the name of that? In the Beat era. Let's see if you get the comparison too. In the Beat era, there was an Allen Ginsberg poem called "A Supermarket in California." The Eric Erickson piece is called "A Congressman's Profanity-Laced Tirade in a Safeway Grocery Store." Yeah, that's how my mind works. Sorry, those are these. I'll be so glad when artificial intelligence gets here, because the organic version's just too freaking weird. Eric Erickson begins, "If we're going to lose because of him, we might as well impeach this motherfucker," said the congressman as we roamed the aisles of a Safeway grocery store together. The Allen Ginsberg poem begins, "What thoughts have I of you tonight, Walt Whitman? For I walk down the side streets under the trees with a headache, self-conscious looking at the full moon. In my hungry fatigue and shopping for images, I went into the neon fruit supermarket dreaming of your enumerations. What peaches and what penumbras, whole families shopping at night, aisles full of husbands, wives in the avocados, babies in the tomatoes, and you, Garcia Lorca, what were you doing down by the watermelons?" Mm-hmm. In turn, Eric Erickson, who is by no means at all, Allen Ginsberg, he says, "I haven't been in a Safeway since my family moved home from Dubai in 1990. The congressman did not want to be seen with me on Capitol Hill. He needed to get some stuff anyway and decided he'd let me walk with him through the cereal and dairy selections down at the Safeway near my hotel. And you, Garcia Lorca, what were you doing down in the watermelons?" No, that part's not in there. But there's a reference. There is a reference that is just inescapable. And it reminds me of the fact that, well, if you are a listener to this program, and I think we can go away from Allen Ginsberg now. I've worked that to pieces. But if you, the long and the short of it is, he refers along the way, this mystery congressman does, he refers to Donald J. Trump as Forrest Gump. And I just want to take a moment to point out that, once again, if you're a listener to this program, you're ahead of the curve. That or this particular right-wing Republican congressman listens to this program, which I find entirely difficult to credit. But the Forrest Gump comparison was made on this program a couple of months back. And yet here it is popping up again, out of the mouth of an anonymous Republican congressman who is male, and not on the House Judiciary Committee, who lives in a district that Trump carried, and among others, the gang at Wonkette, and the gang at Samantha Bee's program applied their deductive reasoning skills and came to the conclusion that the mystery congressman in question is Peter King of New York, whose district Trump won comfortably but not overwhelmingly, like 54% to 44% or something like that. And the Samantha Bee's folks figured out actually has made a prior reference to Forrest Gump. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just apropos of nothing, I suppose. But we beat this congressman, if it is Peter King, to the Forrest Gump reference a couple of months back. Of course, the funniest part of all this is the little mini tirade that the congressman goes into against the movie Forrest Gump, saying that he hates that movie. And in point of fact, I do too. I despise the movie Forrest Gump. And I despise the movie Forrest Gump because I so love the book. I've got a really warm spot in my heart for the for Forrest Gump, the book, because I bought it at a supermarket in Atlanta. Wow. See how the theme develops, even though I'm not entirely aware that that's how it's going to happen. Ixnay, Asa. Brother Deacon Asa pointing out, it is also entirely possible that you, Kincaid, are that Republican congressman who's been doing a daily radio show under the pseudonym Bob Kincaid. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it, damn it. I thought I had covered my tracks. Damn it. Yes, flying to Washington, D.C. every day and leading a double life as a terrorist, an Irish terrorist sympathizer on Long Island. Well, I have been unmasked. No, not really. But I'm fond of Forrest Gump by Winston Groom because I was spazzing out something fierce one night. I was off work at CNN that day because the next morning I had to get up, go downtown, and go onto the campus of Georgia State University and sit, because I had decided, well, why not, and sit for the law school aptitude test, the LSAT. And I figured it was just kind of a lark. You know, no way was I going to be able to score well enough to get into law school or anything. But nonetheless, I don't like failing at things. And so there I was at 11 o'clock in the Kroger on Piedmont Road in Atlanta. The first grocery store I ever saw with a sushi bar in it. And I was desperate for something to read, something to get my mind off the spazziness that went with the night before the LSAT. Because at that point in time, I was worried about, you know, I'll oversleep. I knew I was going to have to use mass transit because there wasn't parking worth a damn downtown in Atlanta. Because Atlanta. And so I was wandering that aisle, the books and magazines aisle in that Kroger. And the name Forrest Gump and the cover of the little paperback caught my eye. It wasn't very thick at all. And I stood there and read the first few pages. That's kind of like cheating, isn't it? But, you know, you buy the damn book. But no, I stood there reading it to make sure that it didn't suck. And it so didn't suck. By the time I was two or three pages in, I was laughing harder than I'd laughed at anything since Mark Twain. And so I hurried with my book and checked it out and went on back to my little apartment on the Chattahoochee River and sat there, and for the rest of the night, I devoured the book version of Forrest Gump. There was no movie version at that point in time. And I laughed and I laughed and I continue to laugh every time I read it. And as is so often the case, when some movie maker gets a hold of a book, they ruin it. But the problem was that it actually won an Academy Award or two that year, which was, and Tom Hanks, whatever great kind of guy he is, collector of typewriters, whatever, it just was the ruination of the character. You know, playing him as some sort of cracker ass gumbo mouth dipshit. And the book, it was, you know, the book includes a chess playing cannibal, an orangutan who runs off to the forest with a female astronaut, an orangutan named Sue, by the way, and among other things, those Zelig-ish scenes where he shows up in all kinds of different places. That much is true about the book. But there's the scene that he had been, after he got shot in Vietnam, he went to meet Lyndon Johnson at the White House, and they watched the Beverly Hillbillies together and just laughed and laughed. He liked LBJ, Forrest Gump did. And then he shows up at the Nixon White House, and he says, so I asked the president what was on TV, since how we'd watched it last time, and he said, to tell the truth, but you don't want to watch that. It's a bunch of shit. Beautiful line. Just beautiful comic line. To tell the truth, but you don't want to watch that. It's a bunch of shit. And so the ruination of that book, that's why I hate the... But anyway, so there's a digression into hating Forrest Gump. But the larger, you know, the larger question is one of gutless Republicans who know that we are in the hands of a madman, but who refuse to do anything about it because they keep getting things that they want. It's like having an abusive parent who buys you a new bicycle after he beats the shit out of you. As long as the bicycles keep coming, well, you know, take your lumps and don't complain, right? But it does make sense that it would be Peter King. And it would be kind of interesting if people would begin to press him on it. Because one of the things he said in the piece is that, yes, he would happily vote for impeachment after the primaries are over. And if all the Democrats, like we've talked about before, maybe this is a suitable topic for Friday on the Front Porch. As we've talked before, if you've got all the Democrats, it doesn't take that many Republicans to get the rest of the way. So that's just a starting place, but there are ever so many other places to go with this Friday on the Front Porch. Thorn in the Side Thursday. See, you've got me thinking about Friday on the Front Porch already because I love it so much. And that being the case, well, we had the confirmation hearing for Mike Pompeo today. I did my part, and I called my two senators' offices and made my thoughts plain on it. To the extent that I was probably significantly outnumbered, because I live in the almost Trumpiest place on earth. Yes, I do. But there are more stories of right-wing perfidy and Republican corruption to delve into in this Thorn in the Side Thursday. But I'd like to. I'd like to sort of backtrack to Wednesday, if we could. Because there was another hearing on Wednesday. In this case, a hearing for a federal judgeship. And in point of fact, and I didn't realize this until I saw the name, and then the memories came flooding back. Triggering is like that. But I saw the name and I didn't realize she... Do you remember years and years and years ago when good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical... Well, I don't know if he's evangelical or not. But anyway, he was a good, fine, family-values Christian Republican by the name of David Vitter, who at the time was a member of the House of Representatives. Well, he... He got caught. He got caught up in the DC Madam scandal, and it turned out he was one of the Johns. And of course, David Bitter had a long history of fulminating against, you know, the homosexuals and talking about the importance of traditional family values and marriage between one man and one woman. And when he got busted, one of the things he did is he hauled out his wife and made that poor woman stand on the podium with her while he did his best Jimmy Swaggart impression. You remember that. I have sinned against you. Now put me in the Senate. Which the people of Louisiana promptly did. They took a known John, an obviously outed, raging hypocrite, and sent him to the Senate of the United States. And he only recently stopped senatoring. For a while, he lived in the same building that we were in with the 8 campaign. And goodness me. The sight of David Bitter in a sleeveless tank top white T-shirt and a pair of long, baggy, shiny, neon orange gym shorts on his way down to the basement where we lived to do his laundry. That one's going to stick with me for a while. And I'd see him every now and then. And, you know, then I'd see a clip of him on the TV later that day. Hemming and hawing about, you know, that Obama or what. Well, son of a gun, if his wife hasn't been nominated to be a United States District Judge in Louisiana stand. She rose to prominence because she is well-known in the fetus fetish circles as being an anti-abortion lawyer there in New Orleans. She's nominated for the Eastern District of Louisiana. That takes in New Orleans. At present, she is general counsel for the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of New Orleans. And, okay, so what? Well, so along comes a question that should have been, arguably would be easy for just about anybody. This is not the abortion debate. Nobody asked her to acknowledge in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee how much respect she has for Planned Parenthood, or even to acknowledge that under Roe versus Wade, there is an acknowledged right to privacy, which guarantees a woman the right to choose. None of that. No. Instead, Senator Richard Blumenthal asked her, I mean, this is a softball, okay? This is one of those that looks like a cantaloupe coming over the plate, and if you don't make it unplayable and put it in the cheap seats, that's on you, sister. But Wendy Vitter couldn't do it. Wait till you hear what the question was about.
Do you believe that Brown versus Board of Education was correctly decided?
Senator.
One, consider that you could drive that was a long pause even for me. You could drive a truck through that. Do you believe that Brown versus Board of Education was correctly decided? And of course, we recently noted the passing of the named plaintiff in this case. May she rest in power. And we marked, we talked about the importance of Brown versus Board of Education, how it dismantled once and for all the notion that separate but equal facilities were acceptable in this country as they had been promulgated by Plessy versus Ferguson. And the and how they validated, I believe it was Justice Harlan's dissent in Plessy, where he said, one of these days we're going to be proved wrong on this case, and it's going to, we're going to look like fools. Not in those exact words, but close enough. Well, agreed. Marty says, Bob, that was a long pause for William Shatner. And of course, when you're going to be confirmed by the Senate, you know, they tell you don't give any hasty answers or anything. But was there are two questions for a judicial nominee? Was Plessy versus was Brown versus Board of Education correctly decided? And how about was the Dred Scott case wrongly decided? Where the answer is just boop. And nobody expects you to think about it because there's only one right answer. Well, apparently not if you are Wendy Vitter, spouse of Diaper Dave from Louisianistan.
Do you believe that Brown versus Board of Education was correctly decided?
Senator, I don't mean to be coy, but I think I get into a difficult area when I start commenting on Supreme Court decisions, which are correctly decided and which I may disagree with. Again, my personal political or religious views I would set aside. That is Supreme Court precedent. It is binding. If I were honored to be confirmed, I would be bound by it, and of course I would uphold it.
Do you believe it was correctly decided?
And again, I will respectfully not comment on what could be my boss's ruling, the Supreme Court. I would be bound by it. And if I start commenting on I agree with this case or don't agree with this case, I think we get into a slippery slope.
Let me just say wow. Wow. Now, bear in mind, of course, that she is going to sit in a federal courthouse in a city that is almost 60% African-American and was more than that before the depopulation that followed in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. This is also the same city from which the fact pattern developed that gave us Plessy versus Ferguson. If there is a single lawyer in the entire United States of America who thinks that Brown versus Board of Education was wrongly decided, that lawyer probably has a pillowcase over his or her head. And no, whether or not Brown versus Board of Education was correctly decided does not call on her to go down a slippery slope. Unless, of course, somewhere in the dim and dark and apparently spider-ridden recesses of her mind, she thinks that there's a compelling argument for separate but equal accommodations in public facilities for people of color. But regardless, she got a nomination to be a federal judge because she's a fetus fetishist. So we know pretty well how she's going to rule if some fetus or the fetus's next friend brings a case before her. But everyone interested in public education has reason now to fear this woman. Because she's not quite sure. And the language she uses is more than a little bit suspect. The language that she uses to try to weasel out of the question leaves her sounding like she thinks it might have been wrongly decided. Listen again.
A different, difficult area when I start commenting on Supreme Court decisions, which are correctly decided and which I may disagree with.
Arguably, she is setting up a dichotomy between cases that are correctly decided versus cases that she might disagree with. But it sounds as though she's saying that she acknowledges the case was correctly decided, but she disagrees with the outcome of Brown versus Board of Education. And maybe that's because the goddess of irony had her hand up her back and was operating her little right-wing fetus fetishist mouth when she was speaking. That answer is sufficient to disqualify her as a judicial nominee. And should disqualify her. But of course, the Senate Judiciary Committee Republicans will all vote in favor of her nomination and send it to the floor, where she'll get a lot of huzzas, and all the old white men who get stiffies when they think about fetuses will, you know, vote in her favor, and bing, lifetime appointment to the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Louisiana, Stan. This does not inspire hope for the future. She's not like 90 bajillion years old. She's going to sit there on that court probably for 40 or 50 years. Lifetime appointment. Again, remember. Steve in New York points out there is one other alternative. Oh. Maybe that's the pause. Yes. Well considered. Well considered, Steve in New York, a member of the Fraternity of Steves. There is one other alternative. She doesn't even know what Brown is. Oh, come on, Steve, really? I mean, I was a C student in law school. Same thing happened to me in law school, happened to me in undergraduate school. The classes that I liked, I kicked ass in, but the ones that I just didn't, I didn't. And it's amazing how not giving a shit about a class will bring that grade point average down. Of course, the state law schools tend to grade on a tougher curve than private law schools do, because frankly, private law schools want to keep that money coming, and the state law school just says, hey, there's somebody right behind you. Fuck you. Get out of here. But I was a C student in law school. And she's counsel for the archdiocese, for God's sakes. I mean, it's not like they can have a coloreds-only section of the Cathedral of St. Louis in New Orleans. She really, Steve? Then again, she's a Trump nominee. She may not know the difference between a writ of prohibition and Rita Hayworth. But she's going to be a federal judge. I know. if you are black and you live in or around the city of New Orleans, not that that city has not been had troublesome relationships between attempts to follow the 14th Amendment and provide equal protection of the law to people of color there for eons, but well, you got one more to add to your list, and that's the Right Honorable Her Honor Judge Wendy Vitter. Of course, you got to consider that federal judging, those are some long, long hours, and you got to wonder what a fella like David Vitter's going to do with all those long, long hours alone. Uh-huh. Yep. Going back to the assertion made earlier by Brother Deacon Asa, Arthur says, Bob is really Representative Steve King. I knew it. I knew that Blues Brothers person on the Twitter account was an imposter. meanwhile, Arnold says, I completely agree with Steve. She did not know what the question was referencing to, and agreeing with you about law school as well. Sorry for the broken English. Voice to text. I love the show. If you listen to the tone of her answer, she has no idea what the context is, and she's going to be a judge. What a f***ing joke. And, you know, telling the story of down there in the basement of the Methodist building a moment ago, I got a note from Silent R. Lamar. Subject line just says, No, Bob. D. Vitter, T-shirts and shorts. Brother, you need eye bleach. It's too late for the eye bleach, Silent R. Lamar. I need brain bleach, and I'm not allowed to drink that stuff anymore. Swirly straw or no swirly straw, because, after all, tequila is brain bleach. All right, Steve. Steve says, honestly, tell me. That a level of that ignorance is surprising from anything that would accept a nomination from the Saffron Stalin. By the way, yes. Little cowbell for Saffron Stalin. Are they all intellectually deficient? Is that part of the job description? If you've got an IQ above freezing, are you frozen out from the favors of this administration? It almost looks that way. No doubt about it. Like I said, it's a weird day. I mentioned last night that it was reported that John Kelly was horrified, sickened, disgusted, what have you, when the Cantaloupe Claudius described the service of a search warrant. As an attack on our country. Well, what if I told you, and this would be enough to, I'd get my hat and coat. What if I told you that Tangerine Tiberius has at least once looked at his chief of staff and said, John, I really want a Big Mac. Go down to McDonald's, just a few blocks away, and get me some Big Macs. And be quick about it, chop chop. maybe not in those exact words. And, you know, Kelly, I'm not going to lose any, there's no love lost on him because he's just a bigot. He's proven that. But being a Marine, he snapped a salute and said, "Yes, sir." And went down and fetched this petty, pig-eyed, ignorant tyrant some Big Macs. Holy cow. And he's still in the job. Maybe because he fears for the fate of the nation if he leaves. And that is as charitable as you'll ever catch me being to John Kelly. But that's just what a waste of resources. Yeah, I know what a Big Mac costs. A Big Mac costs about it costs at least six times as much as a $10 a month monthly subscriber contributes for 1 3-hour program here. Yeah. But it's not the cost. You don't send General Patton out for a six pack of Diet Coke, and don't bring me any of that new Diet Coke. I hate that. The stuff that tastes like blood orange. I hate it. Wow. Subject line, Wendy Vitter. Scott and Punky with a question. Please refresh my memory. Now, was she the long-suffering, sad-looking woman in the leopard skin print dress standing behind David Vitter when he fessed up to infidelity with a hooker? If so, I'd vote against her for a court appointment on the basis of her lack of discernment. I think... Now, you can check with Chirps the cat, Scott, out there, but I think that may have been a little bit catty. Let's see here. That should get us there. David Vitter press conference adultery. Let's see if it does. Yeah, that's her. That's the same face. It's not like he got divorced and found him a new Mrs. Vitter. And the first note there at C-SPAN, today Louisiana Senator David Vitter and his wife Wendy spoke about his connection to a Washington, D.C. escort service. And that does appear... Is that really leopard print? Yeah, there she is, a holding of his hand. Yeah, that's some kind of jungle animal print, no doubt about it. But of course, everybody in the Senate Judiciary Committee had the common decency not to ask her about that. Although, arguably, now that we consider it, wait a minute. Didn't Hillary Clinton, the devil, didn't she get ceaseless, Springs here, ceaseless rashers of shit from good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered Christians like David Vitter for staying with her husband through the Lewinsky affair? Didn't she? And moreover, isn't Wendy Vitter, isn't she nominated for an actual federal judgeship? And as a nominee for a U.S. District Court judgeship, is she not beholden, is it not incumbent upon her to not only not create impropriety, but even the appearance of impropriety? Is soliciting prostitution a crime in either Washington, D.C. or New Orleans, Louisiana? Yes, it's illegal in both cities. And in forgiving David Vitter and sticking with David Vitter, did she not condone his illegal conduct? Why, yes, as a matter of fact, she did. And if any Democratic nominee for any judicial position could be shown to a bunch of Republicans to have condoned law-breaking by her spouse, that Democrat's nominee would be dead. Wouldn't it? I tend to think so. And this isn't even about being tacky about the sleazy conduct of another hypocritical right-wing Republican. I mean, that's obviously there. But this is actually a matter of rule of law and equal justice and nation of laws and not of persons and all of that high-blown, highfalutin crap that we only hear about when the nominee is a Democrat. Because if the nominee is a Republican, then, well, standard rules apply. I-O-K, I-Y, A-R. It's okay if you're a Republican. Yes, as a matter of fact. So, there's more there than meets the eye. How about that? Funny how it works out that way. Meanwhile, Les says, Scott beat me to it, except I would have ended my comment with a vituperative, which I will not share, but I understand. Yes. I think I've got a great bumper for this, as long as the thing is cooperating. Oh, don't do that. Well, if it's the right one, it'll be the right one. If it's the wrong one, it'll be that too. So, you know, just a couple of things to consider. By the way, today the Oklahoma teachers called off their strike. They declared victory. They said that they had achieved historic gains in the restoration, not the expansion, but merely the restoration of education funding in that benighted white wing stand state. They went back to work, went back to the classrooms, only after the Republican legislature knuckled under and put through the first tax hikes in 25 years in Oklahoma that would generate about $450 million for education. Meanwhile, educators said that, no, what we really need is $600 million. Alicia Priest, interviewed by Reuters, said, "We absolutely have a victory for teachers. Our members are saying they want to go back to the classroom." There are about 40,000 members of the union, of which Alicia Priest is president. Good on you. Good on you, Oklahoma teachers. Don't give up. Keep fighting. Keep struggling. And in fact, they say that they will follow up their victory by continuing to work to evict the more recalcitrant members of the Oklahoma legislature during the midterm elections. So that's good. It gives them something to work toward as we continue through this midterm election year. I'm proud of them. Among other things, I'm proud of teachers for leading the struggle to restore the preeminence of organized labor in demanding decent treatment and honorable, respect for an honorable profession that is deeply underappreciated. So that pretty much gets us to the end of the filibobster. It's about 3 minutes before the hour. It being a Thursday, of course, we have the Green News Report from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And it will, I've got some ideas of where I think the program should go, but that may not necessarily be where you want it to go. The phone lines are open, of course. Area code 304-574-8178. Or toll-free, if you need us to pay the freight, 844-843-4676. That's 844-THE-HORN, T-H-E-H-O-R-N. From anywhere on the planet, you know, you can reach the program. This is a global program that pays no respect to time zones or date lines. If you're awake and you're listening and this program's live, you've got a place to express yourself as long as you're not a nasty little white winger. You're not allowed on the program, asshole. So there's that. And I'll note that within the first hour of the program, we remain stuck at $221 in fundraising to go for the evening, and it's been tough this week. Granted, what that means is that we've got $21 from this evening and then $200 for tomorrow to go. If we could actually wipe it out this evening, then maybe we could take a run at getting started on next week and work ourselves into some more fundraising free radio if it plays out that way. But we've got $221 to go, and it sure would be nice if I could say that was done and we had 2 hours of radio to go through without me having to do this again. Because I hate doing this. All right, let's see if I've got the right track. No, I've got the wrong track. There's the right track. Can anybody name that tune? It works within the context of the Wendy Vitter story. So Let's see which way the program's going to go. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. And yes, of course, I'm Bob Kincaid, not Peter King. It's Thursday, April 12, 2018.
Even in 1958, one of those air pollutants that this Shell researcher reports on was the pollution of the atmosphere by carbon from fossil sources.
Newly unearthed internal documents reveal that Shell Oil knew as early as 1958 that its products caused global warming. Senate Democrats call for EPA Chief Scott Pruitt to resign as internal EPA report undermines Pruitt's claims of unprecedented death threats. Plus,
even if none of those backwards movements actually last, we're still losing chunks of time when we should be participating with the rest of the world in attacking this issue.
Obama EPA Administrator warns of the long-term consequences of Pruitt's reign.
All of those consequences and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
This is a pretty sudden fall from grace for Pruitt, who's been a conservative favorite for his aggressively pro-industry stance. So aggressive, in fact, that even though he is literally in charge of the EPA, his LinkedIn page still lists him as a leading advocate against the EPA's activist agenda.
And it's still true. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, we know that Exxon knew, we know that Mobil Oil knew, and now we know that Shell knew too.
Yep, a stunning trove of internal company documents reveal that Shell Oil did know too. Shell's own scientists, beginning back in the late 1950s, warned company executives of Shell's significant role in causing global warming, and they urged immediate action to avoid catastrophic climate change impacts. Shell's researchers even accurately predicted that the oil industry would eventually face lawsuits and investigations for failing to act on that knowledge. But like ExxonMobil and the rest of the oil industry, Shell instead worked to publicly undermine climate science for decades. In an interview on the broadcast, Carol Muffett, president of the Center for International Environmental Law, said that these new documents provide evidence for the multiple investigations and lawsuits against the oil industry over climate damages.
What we can now show, and this is very legally relevant, is that for decades, Shell was aware of those risks, and it continued to take those risks on the assumption that ultimately it would be consumers and governments that bore the cost rather than Shell itself.
We'll link to Muffett's report on this at greennews.bradblog.com, but some of the material is absolutely jaw-dropping, going back to 1962 with the Shell scientists saying very specifically that CO2 from the burning of fossil fuels causes global warming, the very thing that Shell and Exxon and Mobil and all the rest have been trying to confuse the public about for decades.
This week in politics, an internal EPA memo undermines claims that embattled Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt faces unprecedented security threats. According to Democratic Senators Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island and Tom Carper of Delaware, the unreleased assessment says that EPA's intelligence staff found no specific credible threats to the administrator, who has been under intense scrutiny over his outsized spending on personal security and first-class travel. This week, the EPA fired the career agency official who approved that report, Mario Caraballo. In response, an anonymous career EPA staffer told Politico that Caraballo's firing will not intimidate staff, but will instead, quote, embolden us to leak more to get these criminals out.
Go get them.
Senate Democrats on Wednesday formally called for Pruitt to resign or be fired over his multiple ethical scandals and questionable spending. They also announced an attempt to block a confirmation vote of Trump's nominee for the number two spot at EPA. If confirmed, Andrew Wheeler, a coal industry lobbyist and a climate science denier, would take over the EPA should Pruitt exit. But as with Pruitt's confirmation vote last year, Democrats may not be able to muster the votes to block Wheeler. This week, two coal state Democratic senators, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, announced they would support Wheeler's confirmation.
Incredible.
Finally, in an interview with WGBH in Boston, former Obama EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy says that while Pruitt has succeeded in attacking science on behalf of polluting industries and appearing to be effective, the good news is that so far, Pruitt has only launched the process of rolling back major environmental and public health standards, and that can take years and could very well be overturned in court. However, she says the bad news is that much damage can be done in the meantime.
And when he talks about his success, all he talks about is how much he has saved business, as if allowing more pollution wouldn't cause lives to be damaged and health to be damaged. He's doing a terrible job.
But he's doing the job he was hired to do. For much more on all of the stories we covered today and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
And it's 9 minutes past the hour. I just thought that was a great bumper, using Lady Marmalade. The Wendy Davis with the Wendy Bitter with the David Bitter with the hookers and the Colonel Mustard in the conservatory with the rope. But I'll tell you, what a 1975 that, and what a song. You know, one of those things that does grate on me, though, was the remake of it for the awful, awful, awful musical Moulin Rouge, where they changed the lyric to, "I met Marmalade down at old Moulin Rouge," which makes absolutely no sense. But, you know, who the hell am I? It's like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. So one of the what I was worried about was whether this was the original version or the stupid Moulin Rouge version. Why are we even talking about this? During the break, Scott and Punky pointed something out that deserves to be mentioned. Wendy, and maybe this accounts for why she got the nomination in the first place. Wendy Vitter, back during the bad old days of the Clinton administration, well, Wendy Vitter was a lot less hesitant to run her yap. You know, she was downright closed-mouthed about whether or not Brown versus Board of Education was correctly decided, because that could be a slippery slope, and I don't mean to be coy. But she didn't have any coy problems whatsoever way back when she was criticized. She directly criticized Hillary Clinton for sticking with Bill Clinton when, you know, the whole Lewinsky thing broke. Yeah. And then he made her get up to the microphone and defend him. The story coming from America Blog, John Aravosis, from July the 16th, 2007. And back then, John Aravosis closed the story with, "Yeah, nice leopard dress." Yeah, wonder what John Aravosis thinks of this latest round. Yeah. All right, enough of that. Let's move on to other things. Because there is a rich abundance of them. The question being, we are back, by the way, we are back to discussions of, really, I mean, God help us if anybody ever really does invent a time machine and we can drag Jefferson and Adams and Franklin and those folks up into the modern world and show them the things that occupy our time, because they'll go, if we let them go back to their natural time, they'll just say screw it, and petition the King of England for permission to please, pretty please, can we be part of England again? We were so wrong about all this. It was a terrible mistake. Can we come back? We promise we'll behave. What do I mean? Well, there's a new book out by James Comey, and it's been in the making. I'm sure he was handsomely paid for it, and it was work, so he deserved it. But the stuff that's sneaking out. Or, well, I mean, that's not sneaking out, but the excerpts that are making the rounds now include the powers of description that Comey had honed over years and years and years in the federal law enforcement business. And so we're treated to a close description of what it's like when you meet up with the Carotene Caligula. He describes him thusly. His face appeared slightly orange, with bright white half moons under his eyes, where I assumed he placed small tanning goggles, and impressively coiffed bright blonde hair, which upon close inspection looked to be all his. I remember wondering how long it must take him in the morning to get that done. Impressively coiffed. Well, of course, now, thanks to Fire and Fury, we know it takes Ivanka about 2.5 hours to get that pile of shit to stay in one place on top of his head. And then there's the question of the handshake. Comey remarks that when he went for the handshake, he tried to pull him in for what is described as a bro hug. And Comey said he was not going to get a hug without being a lot stronger than he looked. He wasn't. And then we get to the business of hands. The book is called A Higher Loyalty, and it's Comey's attempt to justify his actions relative to Trump and, frankly, relative to the rat-fucking that he gave to the Hillary Clinton campaign. But in regard to Geezer Disgustus, he describes him as a person untethered to truth, ego-driven, and about personal loyalty. And there are apparently a lot of little gems. There's the matter of, like I said, we're back to it. We're talking about his hands again. Now, Comey, remember, is 6'8". So even a guy who's 6'2", remember, Dr. Ronnie said he's 6'3", Trump. But even, you know, even 6'3 is going to be, you know, you're going to, have a height and reach advantage. You wouldn't want to be in a boxing ring with that guy. You couldn't get close to him. But he said he appeared shorter than he seemed on a debate stage. And when they shook hands, he said, "Yes, I noted that his hands were indeed smaller than mine, but did not seem unusually so. He didn't have little Keebler elf hands." So this will probably eat up the the better part of tomorrow's news cycle, which makes you wonder what kind of hellish news dump will happen about 22 hours from now. He also goes into the matter of the meeting between Mike Pence and Reince Priebus. Michael Flynn and Sean Spicer. He Comey, as FBI director, briefed them. Mike Rogers was there as NSA director. John Brennan was there as director of the CIA and Department of National Intelligence. James Clapper was there. And he walked away sort of scratching his head. He said they were about to lead a country that had been attacked by a foreign adversary, yet they had no questions about what the future Russian threat might be. Instead, having been briefed on the matter, they started worrying and asking questions about how they could spin what they had just heard to their advantage. This is an ongoing picture of an administration that is completely corrupt and utterly incompetent. in regard to that meeting with Spicer and Flynn et al., he said, as crazy as it sounds, I suddenly had the feeling that in the blink of an eye, the president-elect was trying to make us all part of the same family, and that Team Trump had made it a thing of ours. And then there's a business about the business about trying to intervene on Flynn's behalf. He's a good guy. I hope you can let this go. And he asks a salient question. If he says he didn't point out that it was inappropriate for him to say that. But Comey asks the question, if he did not know what he was asking was improper, why had he run everybody out of the room, including United States Attorney General Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions the Third, as well as Mike Pencilneck Geek? And speaking of Mike Pencilneck Geek, I want to backtrack once more, sorry, to the issue of the Eric Erickson piece about the Congressman X, because there's another little nugget in there that you might find salient to the ongoing discussion. And that comes within the conversation about impeachment, because there was a significant rant in the thing about impeachment. Waiting for the damn thing to open. In particular, once they get past the issue of how awful Forrest Gump is as a movie, they move on to some other issues. And, you know, it's entirely possible that Eric Erickson made all this crap up. But I tend not to think so. It has the stench of truth about it. The little line about Nancy Pelosi screwing up the House cafeteria it gives it that little nudge of reality. I do love that line, though. It's like Forrest Gump won the presidency, but an evil, really fucking stupid Forrest Gump. He can't help himself. He's just a fucking idiot who thinks he's winning when people are bitching about him. He really does see the world as ratings and attention. I hate Forrest Gump, so there's that part. But then this, and I mention this because it has been brought up in conversation on this program. If we get to summer, and most of the primaries are over, they just might pull the trigger if the president fires Mueller. The shit will hit the fan if that happens, and I'd vote to impeach him myself. Most of us would, I think. Hell, all the Democrats would. And you only need a majority in the House. If we're going to lose because of him, we may as well impeach the motherfucker. Take him out with us and let... And this is the part I wanted to get to. Take him out with us and let Mike Pence take over. At least then we could sleep well at night. Well, speak for yourself. But then this. You know, because he gets kind of... You can imagine him... getting kind of introspective over by the frozen Brussels sprouts. I thought of that scene with Steve Martin and Carol Kane in My Blue Heaven, where he falls in love with her at first sight. You know, she's got that, she's all dressed up, you know, like a trashy mob mall, you know, speaking of leopard print. And he says, "You shouldn't be in here. You could melt all this stuff." And, of course, she just immediately falls for him and his line of bullshit. But, no, I've got this image of him saying this over by the frozen Brussels sprouts. And he says, "At least we could sleep well at night." You know? And, again, this is another one of those moments that gives this the ring of truth, because Republicans think like this. Not is it good for the country, not is it bad for the country, but will it make Democrats' heads explode? You know, having Mike as president would really piss off all the right people, too. They think they hate Trump. Mike is competent. And, of course, again, that issue has raised its head on this program. What do you want to do? You want to leave a guy in the Oval Office who at any moment in time might decide to torch the world because the French fries that he sent John Kelly to get down at the McDonald's were cold? Or do you want a calculating, theocratic, evangelical liar who, with the nuclear arsenal in his hands, might just decide one day that a big nuclear conflagration was just the bat signal that old Jeebus needed to tell him it was time to come down from heaven in his holy roles and get to tribulating and millennializing and premillennializing and rapturing and seven-headed serpents rising from the sea and whore of Babylon and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, right. And I guess that's a real consideration. But from my perspective, I think you deal with the problem at hand. And the problem at hand is the madman in the White House. The petulant septuagenarian toddler. And he just keeps melting. I mean, the business about how he's tweeting over whatever the response to the gas attack in Syria is going to be. Well, maybe we'll do it now, or maybe we'll do it later. But you better be ready for it. You better be. Yeah, fuck. He's owned by Vladimir Putin, and he's doing his. He thinks he's being cute and coy. There's that word again. And clever. When he's telegraphing to Putin our plans, which would be sufficient to get any other president of the United States impeached, if not charged with some sort of breach of a statute having to do with traitors and treason. Oh, and by the way, thanks have to go out. Thanks very kindly to Frank, who took us down we've got multiple Franks. Thank you, Frank, for taking us down to $200 to go. And thank you to Jason, who then took us down to $194.45. Because I love ciphering. So we've got $194.45 to go to finish out fundraising for the week and finish it out. For this evening, and maybe give us a leg up on just a little bit more fundraising free radio at the end of the month. So being done by the end of the evening would be huge. Now, what else? Well, we may as well stay generally on topic. He went out to a speaking engagement today. Marcus Aurelius did. In point of fact, he went out to the White House lawn. It was a good day to be on the lawn. I don't care. Well, it was apparently pretty in D.C. It was gorgeous here. We're gonna have three gorgeous days. Today was the best, most beautiful, pleasant day of 2018 thus far. Here in the hills and hollers of almost level West by Cole Trump Jr. stand. And tomorrow promises to be even better with a high of 81 degrees. And Agnes and I are thinking about maybe getting up early and going out for a nice long 2-3-4 hour hike along the canyon rim just to sort of have some pleasant time together and you know, recharge our existential batteries and look at the natural beauty. One of the things that I did notice, I love the red buds. I love the red buds here in Appalachia. They're usually the first color of spring. But since we had that bizarre early spring in mid-February and then got our asses frozen off in March, apparently the red buds didn't bloom, or they tried and got frozen. Because I noticed that the bushes, where the red bud bushes, the red buds come onto the bush before the leaves do. And the leaves are there, but the blooms never came. And that's a shame, because the pinking of the hills is, it's about as pretty a thing as you can see in floral nature in this region. But that's what, we may do that tomorrow. But it was a nice day in D.C. And once again, as he walked out to the White House lawn to blather on about the tax cuts, they had to do that because now it's becoming apparent that by 2020 the tax cuts will have run the deficit up over $1 trillion. And I mean, there's no way to bullshit your way out of that. And eventually it may just, crush the economy like a bug. But when he goes out to talk about something, because his brain is so addled, he has to freestyle. And he has to go off message because he thinks, if we can use that verb with Donald Trump, he thinks he is displaying his genius. He thinks he's showing us all how smart he is. When the fact of the matter is, he's doing nothing but showing himself to be the fool that he is. He's still going on about the regulations that they've slashed, the regulations that did things like make it a little more likely for children not to grow up in Appalachia with a bunch of diseases, the regulations that prevented coal companies from burying streams that have been around for, a couple of million years or so. He's so goddamn proud of that. But then he went in a different direction, because he had to. I mean, there's no there. There's no focus. There's nothing but a straight pipe from his id to his tongue.
Cutting record numbers of regulations. We've cut more regulations in a year and a quarter than any administration, whether it's 4 years, 8 years, or in one case, 16 years. Should we go back to 16 years? Should we do that? Congressman, can we have that extended? You know, the last time I jokingly said that, the papers started saying, he's got despotic tendencies. No, I'm not looking to do it. Unless you want to do it, that's okay.
Oddly enough, and y'all can hate me if you want to, it's free. We come back to the question of term limiting presidents. This guy is not going to last 12 more years or 16. Simply not going to happen. He can barely stand up to the rigors of the presidency a year and not quite 3 months into the process. And so he jokes about a 16-year presidency, because that's one of the things. Again, he's just a bundle of an adipose jiggling bundle of insecurities and fears and jealousies, and he wants to be number one in everything. And that includes maybe having as many terms as Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He really does think he would like to cling to power that long. The presidency eats people. Unless you're a Republican, in which case it takes almost no toll at all. But if you pay attention to the job, if you care about the job, it will take its toll on you. You remember how young Barack Obama looked like, a 30-something when he got the office. And he left the office gone gray. The same thing happened to Jimmy Carter. The same thing happened to Bill, speaking of Big Macs, Bill Clinton was a Big Mac munching son of a gun, young and vibrant, and what, within 2 years of leaving the Oval Office, he's on his back on an OR table having his chest cracked. Because if you treat it with the seriousness it deserves, it is a brutally damn difficult job. On the other hand, if, as the guy we're thinking is Peter King said, you get up and shit all over Twitter, and then you shit all over Congress, and then you shit all over everybody else, and then go hit golf balls, how's that any different from living in Trump Tower? The only difference being that he actually gets his way a little bit, slightly less of the time as president, because he can't just show up on page six and divert people's attention. But the 24th Amendment, I think, was ill passed. I know I've talked about this before, but this is a good reminder. I'll roll the dice on Trump. I'll say, okay, you guys want to get busy. 2/3 of the House, 2/3 of the Senate, and 2/3 of the state, and let's repeal the 24th Amendment. Because someday this country is going to have a crisis like it had in 1941 and the years leading up to it and the Depression. And changing horses because we've got an arbitrary constitutional amendment that says, well, sorry, it doesn't matter what's going on in the country. It doesn't matter how good the president is. The president can't be president anymore because a bunch of pissed off, petulant Republicans in the 1950s were mad that Franklin Roosevelt had 4 terms. That's just dumb. And when the time comes that we really, really need to keep a good president, we probably won't be able, we won't have the luxury of time in which to repeal the amendment. So if the maggots want to make it possible for him, and I know our side would have a baby at the very idea, but if they want to do that, go for it. Because it would actually be a pro-democracy step. And I'd support it. Because it was a terrible idea to begin with. And remind me sometime to talk about the... this is probably not the right time for it, but... I've been doing a lot of reading and a lot of thinking about the Wilson presidency and some of the stuff that arose out of that. You know, he had a vice president from Indiana too. And there's a conversation to be had when the moment is right about all of that. Okay, so Scott and Punky want us to know that April 17th, James Comey will be a guest of Stephen Colbert's on the Late Show. Set your TiVos. And a note coming in from Steve in New York. Subject line triage. The, but if we get rid of Trump, we get Pence nonsense is just that, nonsense. This is triage. One addresses the threat one has at hand, and then... there's this, no Trump will mean Pence, which does suck. However, no Trump also means no Uday, no Kusei, no Ivanka, no Jared, nor any of the other cockroaches that infest and infect our government. Well, I think Steve and I are of like mind on this issue, because... You can't what if Pence. You can't let the bull, okay, he's not a bull. You can't let the bullshitter ramble around the China shop and just wreck the place because you're afraid of what may be behind the bull. Because if you let the bull keep wrecking the China shop, bullshitter, then it won't matter what comes after, because the place will already be wrecked. And in some, and look, the people who support Trump, the weirdos, you know, the real hardcore, cancerous knot of dead-enders, the maggots, they're not going to get excited about Mike Pencilneck Geek. Because he's not, because the things that make them love Geezer Disgustus are not present in Pence. I mean, I know it's gross and everything, but the maggots like the fact that he's a sexual abuser and sexual assaulter. They dig that. They think it's cool. They think it shows that he's an alpha male and not some beta cuck. They use language like that, you know? And meanwhile, Mike Pencilneck Geek is the very modern model of evangelical rectitude, because after all, he calls his wife mother and won't be alone in a room with a woman not his wife. I guess because he's afraid that his sinful nature will overpower him and his animal magnetism will overpower her, and then they'll, you know, then they'll just be wallering around on the floor, you know. And there he was, a-ruttin' on my Mayella. But the maggots like that he gets up and shits all over Twitter. They like that he shits on his own allies. They like that he makes a mockery of people like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, because even if they were doing what the maggots like, they don't like the fact that they do them within the framework of something as boring as governance. They like to see things broken for the sake of breaking them. That's all there is to it. And we're gonna keep on dealing with Michael Cohen, who is remaining steadfastly loyal to Donald Trump because he's afraid that otherwise he and his beloved family will be found or not found in the trunk of some vehicle off of the New Jersey Turnpike somewhere, or going sightseeing at the bottom of the East River. Michael Avenatti showed up on Nicole Wallace's program on MSNBC. She asked him about the status of Mr. Cohen relative to the lawsuit that Avenatti filed on behalf of Stormy Daniels. The answer is more than a little bit interesting.
Stormy. So let's talk to the man behind the storm.
Come on. You can do it.
Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels' attorney, is back with us. We spoke Monday. I told you then I was living dog years. Monday night, Tuesday night, one night. There are developments since then, since that raid on Michael Cohen's offices and home. What's your understanding of where things stand with Mr. Cohen, your adversary in this legal contest about Stormy Daniels' NDA?
Well, we've learned moments ago, within the last 2 hours, that Michael Cohen will be filing a motion tomorrow in our case, an emergency motion, to stay or temporarily stop our case. And the grounds for that motion are going to be that it is his intention to plead the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination if our case goes forward, in light of potential criminal jeopardy that he finds himself in. So this is a stunning development.
Let me just get you to restate that for the non-legal beagles out here. Michael Cohen, who has been essentially in hand-to-hand combat with you over the enforcement of Stormy Daniels' NDA, is now going to plead the Fifth?
That's what we have been informed by his counsel. You may recall that 1 week ago today, the president stood on Air Force One and told the American public and the press that if they had any questions about what happened relating to the agreement or the payment, that they could pose those questions to his attorney, Michael Cohen. He was emphatic and clear about that. We are now 1 week later. On Monday, we had a raid of three locations associated with Michael Cohen. Today, we find out that it is his intention to plead the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination in response to any questions that I may pose in connection with our case. They are going to seek an emergency stay. We have agreed to a briefing schedule relating to their motion. We're going to oppose that stay. We think we have very good grounds as to why there should be no delay in our case. But make no mistake about it. We're talking about the attorney to the President of the United States, the man that knows where a lot of bodies are buried, and we have learned within the last hour or two that it is his intention to plead the Fifth Amendment.
What?
Hold on a minute. Okay, so there was a little reference there. I asked something about the search warrant a couple of nights ago, namely, or maybe it was last night, I asked if you were... Why wouldn't you search his home that is allegedly being renovated? And I was under the impression they served the search warrant on his apartment, or not on his apartment, but on the hotel room where he's staying with his family, and on his law office. Now he says there's three locations that have been searched. Is one of them his home? I need to do a little bit more digging on this issue. But here's one that might be kind of fun to think about. What if, for lack of a better term, we'll call it the smoking gun? What if the smoking gun is sitting there tucked away in the White House? Michael Cohen, Donald Trump is his client. Michael Cohen comes and goes to the White House as needed. What if the really incriminating shit is under Donald Trump's mattress? Now, this is admittedly, to a certain extent, that kind of nerdy law school speculation that fuels the beer-sodden Friday nights among first semester 1Ls getting their first dose of criminal law. But what if? Because we're dealing here with a criminal enterprise. We're dealing with crooks and allegations of criminal conduct. If your client is the President of the United States, would you maybe, if you're somebody like Michael Cohen, think that the best place to hide your dirty business would be in plain sight? And this is Edgar Allan Poe Sherlock Holmes stuff. How would you go about it? What happens if the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York and the FBI office in Manhattan, what happens if they develop evidence to suggest that what they know to exist is not within their trove, and they develop reason to believe that it's in the White House? How do you serve a search warrant on the White House? How do you get a federal district judge or a U.S. magistrate, I'm not sure who, to okay that? I don't know if Steve in New York's still out there listening. I don't know if Billable Rick is either. I mean, ostensibly it's any other address. It's just like any other address. Naming the place to be searched and the things to be seized within the language of the Fourth Amendment. But can you imagine for a moment what that would be like to have the FBI come rolling up to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and the armed people, the Marines and whatnot? Son, we've got a search warrant. You got to let us through. Hoo-ah, no, sir. I'll protect the president. Hoo-ah. What do you think? And, of course, if you had them tucked away in the White House, the shredders could go nonstop, couldn't they? You know, as long as the person doing the shredding was somebody that Geezer Disgustus trusted implicitly, like Ivanka. Hoo-wee! This has gone from being speculation about a bit of dirty business in the White. This is a plot to a summer blockbuster thriller movie. Now watch it show up on HBO or Stars or something. You're welcome. And since when is a threat to take the Fifth Amendment grounds to continue a case and indefinitely and prevent it from going forward? Well, I'm sorry, I'm a witness in this case, but I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment because I just got raided by the FBI. So we can't let the case go forward, Your Honor. That's just nuts. Now, if there's a jury trial, the jury would be told or not told, depending on what the lawyers agreed on. The fact that somebody gets on the stand and takes the Fifth Amendment is not to be taken as an indication that this person has in any wise violated the law. It is their constitutional right to not speak if they fear that they will incriminate themselves. Some lawyers will say, well, you know, and other lawyers, oh, hell no. And it's generally understood you can't put somebody on the stand simply to make them take the Fifth Amendment. There has to be a good faith effort to elicit evidence in front of the tribunal. But you get the idea that maybe Michael Avenatti is a little bit better lawyer than the pettifogging ambulance chasers and nasty gram drafters with which Trump has surrounded himself over the course of years. Roy Cohn was not a great trial lawyer. I suspect Michael Cohen is not a great trial lawyer either. They're fixers. They're pettifoggers. Now let's go back and get a little bit more from Michael Avenatti.
Relating to their motion, we're going to oppose that stay. We think we have very good grounds as to why there should be no delay in our case, but make no mistake about it. We're talking about the attorney to the President of the United States. The man that knows where a lot of bodies are buried, and we have learned within the last hour or two that it is his intention to plead the Fifth Amendment.
What? So you plead the Fifth if you are afraid that your testimony will incriminate you. You don't take the Fifth if you're innocent, right? Is that a layperson's understanding of the Fifth Amendment?
Well, there's a lot of reasons to plead the Fifth. It's a constitutional right that's available to all Americans. But I find this incredibly ironic because Donald Trump has been very outspoken in the past about people that plead the Fifth. He has a number of quotes on the record. He was quoted extensively during the campaign as it related to various individuals pleading the Fifth. And I'm going to paraphrase some of those quotes. I think he said that only mobsters plead the Fifth, and you only plead the Fifth if you're guilty.
Let me ask you to do a little bit of legal analysis for us. With that as the development today, a rather stunning development, it would seem, where do you think that raid is leading the federal investigation into other potential crimes by Mr. Cohen? And this is not obviously involving your client, Stormy Daniels, but you know a lot about Mr. Cohen. You're obviously someone who studies the enemy. And I wonder what you have learned about your...
He is your prey. And you are a raptor. Go ahead, Nicole. Use the fun stuff.
Legal enemy in the Stormy Daniels case, and what you make of pleading the Fifth and of the raid on his house, and what other leads you think they're chasing?
Well, here's what I'll say. We're cooperating extensively with attorneys from the Southern District of New York, office of the U.S. Attorney. There is no question that these folks are very dedicated, focused, and smart as it relates to this investigation. There is also no question in my mind that Michael Cohen finds himself in a very, very bad place. It's a place that I predicted a number of weeks ago that would ultimately he would ultimately find himself in. And I think the likelihood of this not ending well for him is high, extremely high. And I'm going to go back to something that I've said consistently, and that is that if he buckles under pressure, buckles under the intense scrutiny that he's going to be placed under in an effort to save himself and not serve time or to curtail the amount of time that he could potentially face, I think this is going to end very, very badly for the president.
Can we go?
One can only hope. Note coming in from Flavio. Oh, by the way, thank you. Thank you very kindly, Keith. Keith saved me a little bit of cipher, and Keith just took us down to $184 even to... $184 to go to finish fundraising, and that is a huge help. So, ten at $18.40, or 18.4 people at $10. That's complicated, but that's where we stand. $184. I think we're going to continue this conversation. I'm going to take a little break real quick, and we'll continue on the topic in just a moment, but. You know, I'm an old DJ. I can't help myself. Thinking about all those little maggots out there wandering around just, I want to see him break something else. Yeah, Cletus, you're going to love it when he does something like, you know, break your Social Security or your health care. I just want to make America great again. Anyway, this is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob. And maybe that 184 will go down a little bit more. Thanks. We'll be right back.
I love the sound of breaking glass, especially when I'm lonely. I need the noises of destruction.
Yeah, Nick Lowe. I love the sound of breaking glass. And it's practically an anthem for the maggots. So 4 minutes past the hour. If you want to get involved, if you want to engage in conversation on the program, you're more than welcome to. I trust you know the numbers, unless you're brand new to the program. Question came in from Flavio. If the FBI can search a congressperson's office, why not the White House? Well, I didn't say they couldn't, Flavio. I said it would be a mess, and it would be a dramatic free-for-all. And a congressperson's office is not also their residence. And the question then, because nobody's ever served a search warrant on the residence of the President of the United States. Just haven't. Meanwhile, Steve in New York says, here's what I think. For federal crimes, Mueller could offer to speak with Cohen to see what he knows that would make him plead the Fifth Amendment. For state crimes, A.G. Schneiderman in New York could offer to speak with him to see what he knows that would make him take the Fifth. In either case, Mueller or Schneiderman could offer immunity to him, at which point he would have to testify. At that point, they could ask him if there were records in the White House, and he would have to say so or be jailed until he did. I suspect that all charges would be state court charges, at which point Trump couldn't do a damn thing in the way of a pardon. Once he testified that something was in the White House, they could subpoena them. The precedent is set from Nixon about the president having to turn docs over. Though that was Congress, as I recall, there is fundamentally no difference between a congressional versus judicial subpoena. Except in terms of, enforcement. And some of this stuff may come into play. And it's kind of hard to keep up with everything, but the Washington Post has reported, fake news, Amazon's fake news, it's Amazon's PR department, not a real newspaper, that Michael Cohen would sometimes, as deemed necessary, record conversations with people that he was working with in relationship to the one or two, depending on how you view it, clients that he had, namely Trump and the Trump Organization. One Trump advisor said to the Washington Post, we heard he had some proclivity to make tapes. Now we're wondering, who did he tape? Did he store those someplace where they were actually seized? Did they find his recordings? The question being, did he record conversations with Trump? But then again, the source also noted that Geezer Disgustus knew Cohen recorded people because Cohen would sometimes play the recordings of that he made talking to other advisors of Trump. One individual described it as standard practice. Tim O'Brien, who wrote a biography of Trump, said that Trump told him that their conversations were being recorded. Then it turned out, when there was a lawsuit involved, that Trump had simply been lying about it. Tim O'Brien wrote, back in the early 2000s, Trump used to tell me all the time that he was recording me when I covered him as a reporter for the New York Times. He also said the same thing when I was writing a biography of him, Trump Nation. I never thought he was, but who could be sure? And then when he was deposed, and under oath, Trump said, I'm not equipped to tape record. So you got to imagine that in the inner circle of Trump, there are probably some pretty well developed bowel problems at this point in time. Add that to a tweet from about 7 hours ago from the Mar-a-Lago Mussolini. I have agreed with the historically cooperative, disciplined approach that we have engaged in with Robert Mueller, unlike the Clintons. I have full confidence in Ty Cobb, my special counsel, and have been fully advised throughout each phase of this process. You know what that sounds like? That sounds like the kind of things that people who are pleading guilty to something say in front of the judge when they're entering their guilty plea. And have you been advised of the charges against you?
Yes, I have.
And do you understand those charges?
Yes, I do. I've got a good brain, a very good brain. I graduated first in my class from Wharton, even though I didn't.
And has your lawyer advised you all along the way as to the nature of these charges?
Absolutely. I have full confidence in my special counsel, Ty Cobb. I've been fully advised through each phase of this process.
That was 7 hours ago. The stuff we've been talking about for the last hour or so has developed in the last couple of hours. Including a report from NBC that, and you know, there's not been a lot of leakage out of the Mueller investigation. Those people seem to be pretty serious, and they know that leaks can be damning. This is not the Star investigation. This is not Star Chamber. But it is being reported that the discussions, the negotiations about whether Donald Trump will allow himself to be interviewed by Robert Mueller are essentially over. That impasse has been reached. And as a result of that, it has also been said that the negotiations were a lot further along than anyone thought. And with both sides, this is from the NBC report, with both sides proceeding as though a presidential interview is no longer in the cards, that there's a possibility that Mueller's timetable has been run up as far as delivering a report on obstruction of justice, because there will be no interview. Continuing, Mueller would then likely send a confidential report to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who's overseeing the Russia investigation. Rosenstein could decide whether to make the report public and send its findings to Congress. From there, Congress would then decide whether to begin impeachment proceedings against the president. A couple of noteworthy things there. One, it makes it sound as though the obstruction charge is a foregone conclusion. If Mueller issues a report on obstruction that says, nah, hell no, he didn't obstruct shit, then why would the Congress make even determine whether to begin impeachment proceedings? You don't begin impeachment proceedings against someone who didn't do anything. It also makes it sound like the only reason that he was being offered an interview was so that he could at least make a passing attempt at exculpating himself. That he's already busted. This, however, does not jibe with what was said recently, insofar as it was stated that Donald Trump is a subject but not a target of the investigation. And then, with Steve having mentioned subpoenas, there's the question of, hey, so he refuses to sit down and talk to you, so you're just not okay. Well, you know, let me know how that works out. With every other way that the FBI and the U.S. attorneys operate. Ah, well, you know, I mean, doesn't want to talk to us. I guess, you know, I guess we'll just have to go away. Because that's what the FBI does when somebody doesn't cooperate. They just go away. The FBI never goes away. So why wouldn't Robert Mueller subpoena Geezer Disgustus? I mean, we've got him here. I've agreed with historically cooperative
disciplined approach that we've engaged in with Robert Mueller. I have full confidence. I've been fully advised. Maybe I'm just hoping that Bob Mueller's spoiling for a fight. But then again, he has to be reading the same stuff everybody else is reading. And knowing that Geezer Disgustus is in, you know, sitting in the residence with a Diet Coke and a bag of Cheetos, mumbling about how he has to fire Rosenstein, which would then open the way for him to fire for whoever replaces Rosenstein to fire Mueller. But that in itself would be time-consuming, because the person who would replace Rosenstein would be subject to Senate confirmation. Would that person not be? And you thought Watergate was a Byzantine mess. And you thought Iran-Contra got complicated. Note coming in from Darlene in Connecticut. Subject line, a slippery eel. A dear friend of mine once referred to Comey as such, and that's a perfect description for him. I think you may be giving Comey too much credit. His descriptive writing prowess did not come from years of lawyering. The excerpts you read from his new book sound exactly like his style of writing back in college when he wrote for the William and Mary College newspaper. He's always been quite focused on physical appearance, in particular that of women. I did not know this. He roundly and viciously insulted the looks of Harvard women in one article, quoting what his handsome friend Paul from Harvard had told him. Paul is thought to have not even existed, and that he was in fact the handsome Paul. What he wrote was incredibly degrading to the female students at Harvard. Interesting for a man who acts so sickeningly religious. Of course Comey thinks of himself as handsome. There's a strong ego there for sure, and his book and book tour seem so, unprofessional and very self-serving. I could never see Robert Mueller doing something like this. If Comey hadn't risen to the heights he managed to, I could totally see him being a writer of B-novels. I'm not saying he isn't telling the truth in his book, but he's very unpredictable, almost schizophrenic. When you look at how he handled the Ashcroft in the hospital incident with Mueller backing him up, and juxtapose how he got it so damned wrong and gave Hillary a royal fucking over leading up to the election. Slippery eels don't change their stripes, just saying. I didn't know any of the Harvard stuff. I gotta read. That's disgusting. And of course, remember, he went off and he was corporate counsel to, who was it? I mean, it became very wealthy in the process. And that's one of those roles for, you know, your average garden variety, urbane, sophisticated lawyer. If you go back in the archives of this program, you'll find me describing him as squirrely. What was it? It was the testimony he gave in Congress that involved him using the word lordy. Lordy, I hope so. Some such shit as that. If an obstruction of justice charge hinges on the testimony of James Comey and James Comey alone, that's going to be a bit of a thin reed upon which to hang the case. Regarding Cohen's tapes, Steve asks, might these be the tapes he alluded to regarding Comey? Yeah, we won't know until we know, will we? And that line in the NBC News report about Rosenstein getting a confidential report and then deciding whether to make it public. Look, if this stuff does not become public, whether it be positive or negative, all confidence in any sort of judicial or law enforcement investigatory process will lie shattered in a million tiny pieces on the floor. But I still wonder why this NBC News report just leaps past the idea
that there would ever be a subpoena. Sure wasn't any hesitation subpoenaing Bill Clinton, was there? No. And then there was the thing that was out there earlier today about the one guy that American media, otherwise known as National Enquirer and Radar Online, that there was a payoff for a story about there being another little Trump wandering around out there somewhere. A terrifying thought, if ever there was one. You know, the funny thing is, I didn't mean for the program to be all about this. I got oodles of other stuff, like what an apparent dick. Sorry, bad word. David Smith of Sinclair Broadcasting is, who allegedly tried to keep his neighbors from having access to their own land by putting up posts in a common road based upon a common easement shared by all the tenants. We had that, and then there's the Pompeo hearing. And there was one thing about the Pompeo story that was at least helpful. Cory Booker, Democrat, New Jersey, at least, and I'm going right to the phones in a second here, Cory Booker went after Pompeo for his bigoted Islamophobia, just as we discussed on the program last night.
The themes we talked at length about, and that involves many of your past statements concerning Muslim Americans. And perhaps I just want to start with some of your language. In a speech, you talked about folks who worshipped other gods and called it multiculturalism. You sort of mourn that we live in a country where that happens. Do you have any views that the Muslim faith or people?
That's the very recording we listened to last night. By the way,
believe in worshiping quote unquote other gods. Is that just something negative in our country?
No, Senator. I you can look at my record. You don't have to take my word for it here today. My record is exquisite with respect to treating people of each and every faith with the dignity they deserve, to protect their right to practice their religion or no religion for that matter in the way that they want to. I've done that when I ran Thayer Aerospace and Century International.
And Mr. My time is limited, so if I can follow up.
But it's important because I've heard these critiques and you raised it yesterday. I've worked closely with Muslim leaders, with Muslim countries. The CIA has saved countless thousands of Muslim lives during my 15 months. This is at the core of who I am, Senator Booker, and I promise you that I will treat persons of each faith or no faith with the dignity and respect that they deserve.
Your words right now are really encouraging. Words do matter. It's not just actions. In a nation of bigotry where you see too much bigotry and hatred, you and I both know words matter. So I do understand your actions that you, and I will stipulate to the actions you just said. But I really want to get to the bottom of people who are going to be reading your past statements and give you a chance to further explain them. And I would like to go back to what we talked about, you and I, about this idea.
Yeah, wait a minute. So this is another one of those moments when you really miss a good cross-examiner. Sir, on date, you said the following. Are those your words, sir? Those are your words. Are they not, sir? Yes, they are. So you just told me that, you know, you treat everybody fairly, blah, 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 blah. So were you just shining on the fundies out there in rat's ass Kansas that day? Were you just trying to gin up the rubes? Were you lying to them? Were you Were you blowing smoke up their ass? Is that, and if you were, is that something you routinely do if you think that's what you need to do to get the rubes behind you, sir? But I guess that wouldn't be that wouldn't be civil, would it?
And I'm quoting you, that a special obligation falls on Muslims in regards to terrorist attacks in our country. And you said something very dramatic, and I know you know this. You said that people who are silent are complicit in those terrorist attacks. Do you think that Muslim Americans in this country who serve in our military, who serve in the State Department, their failure to speak up, are they complicit in terrorist attacks?
Senator, each and every human, not just Americans, each and every human being has an obligation to push back against this extremist use of violence from whatever faith.
So you don't create a special...
Yeah, well, bullshit. That's not what you said, you theocratic freak. You said Muslims. You didn't say everybody. You said Muslims. Come on, Corey. You can do better than this.
Class of people in this country based upon their religion that have a special obligation, as you said, to condemn terrorist attacks.
No, Senator. Having said that, I had a chance to talk about this yesterday. I'm not sure we ended up completely agreeing, but perhaps we did. I also do believe this firmly, that for certain places, for certain forms of violence, there are certain who are better positioned, folks who are more credible, more trustworthy, have a more shared experience. And so when it comes to
Christians, Director Pompeo, when it comes to Christians and a Christian has murdered people in a terrorist act in this country, is it incumbent upon other Christians to speak out? If they don't speak out against their homicidal Christian brother, are they complicit in that attack, sir? When Christians didn't speak out against the Christian who assassinated Dr. Tiller, did they become complicit in his murder, sir? I mean,
making sure that we don't have terrorists brewing in places that where Muslims congregate, there's a special place, right? They have an opportunity. It's more than a duty, more than a require. It's an opportunity, right, to be treated as when someone from another faith says it can get characterized.
So if I can go on, because I have some more questions. So you think that Muslims in America who are in positions of leadership have a different category of obligation because of their religion? That's what I'm hearing you saying.
I don't see it. It's not an obligation. It's an opportunity.
Okay, so
Senator,
it's interesting because I would agree with you that silence in the face of injustice, we've seen this in the Holocaust, we've seen this in the Civil Rights Movement, I do agree with you that silence in the face of injustice lends strength to that injustice. I do have a problem, though, when you start creating, dicing up American people and saying certain Americans, I don't care if it's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or Muslims that serve on my staff, that they're in positions of leadership that suddenly have a special obligation. I do believe, though, all of us, when this comes to violent actions or even violent words, have an obligation. And so I'm wondering, sir, do you know Frank Gaffney?
Yes, I do.
And you've been on his show dozens of times.
I was on his show some, yes, Senator.
I have here over 20 times.
Ooh.
And he has talked about Muslims should be, who abide by the adherence of their faith, should be considered, should be tried for acts of sedition and should be prosecuted. Did you remain silent when you were on his show? Did you ever question? Because I have a lot of his statements here. Mm-hmm. Did you remain silent on the? He's, from my notes, at least you're a friend of his. Were you silent in your position of authority against these words that are violative of the American Constitution? Were you silent with him?
Senator, my record on this is unambiguous.
No, it's not unambiguous.
That's your response. You did not say anything to call out his remarks. What about Bridget Gabriel? Do you know her?
I do.
Someone who runs an organization that has been considered a hate group by the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center. Were you silent? Did you ever call her out on her remarks that are hateful or bigoted?
Senator, I've spoken to a number of groups, and I believe my record with respect to tolerance and the equal treatment of people,
yes or no? Did you ever call her out?
Senator, I couldn't tell you. I don't recall each statement I've made over 54 years.
Yeah, the answer is no.
Well,
we've got the recordings.
I believe the special obligation that you talk about for Americans to condemn things or attacking our Constitution, our ideals, would obligate you in your own definition to speak out.
Corey.
I have called out. We had a terrible fellow in Kansas named Fred Phelps.
Sir, I have
him out.
I have a minute left because I do want to give you a chance to speak about your comments on gay and lesbians.
Fred Phelps, that's easy.
You said in a speech that mourning an America that endorses perversion and calls it an alternative lifestyle, those are your words, is being gay a perversion?
Senator, I, when I was a politician, I had a very clear view on whether it was appropriate for two same-sex persons to marry. I stand by that.
So you do not believe it's appropriate for two gay people to marry?
Senator, I continue to hold that view. It's the same view.
And
for the
so people in the State Department, I met some in Africa, that are married under your leadership, you do not believe that that should be allowed?
Senator, I believe it's the case we have married gay couples at the CIA, you should know. I treated them with the exact same set of rights.
Do you believe that gay sex is a perversion? Yes or no?
Senator,
sex is a perversion? Because it's what you said here,
Senator,
in one of your speeches. Yes or no? Do you believe gay sex is a perversion?
Senator, I'm going to give you the same answer I just gave you previously. My respect for every individual, regardless of their sexual orientation, is the same.
So I will conclude by saying,
if I'm confirmed,
I will conclude by saying, sir, you're going to be Secretary of State of the United States at a time that we have an increase in hate speech and hate actions against Jewish Americans, Muslim Americans, Indian Americans. Hate acts are on the increase in our nation. You're going to be representing this country and their values abroad in nations where gay individuals are under untold persecution, untold violence. Your views do matter. You're going to be dealing with Muslim states and on Muslim issues. And I do not necessarily concur that you are pouring the values of our nation when you can't even, when you believe that there are people in our country that are perverse, and where you think that you create different categories of Americans and their obligations when it comes to condemning of violence. So I'll have another round, but thank you.
Once again, proof that there is no God. Because if there was, and if he was serious about that not bearing false witness business, there would have been a lightning bolt that just came right down and just, and there would have been nothing left of Mike Pompeo but a little smoke and greasy spot. Let's go talk to Scott and Punky. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Bob.
You're calm. I'm not.
In listening to that exchange, I don't know if he would have been on the panel, but I mean, as well as Corey did, Corey Booker, it still makes me miss Al Franken.
Well, I don't think he was on that committee, but I get the point.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I want to talk about the documents and gaining access to them if they may be hidden in the White House, but I want to quickly touch back to something we talked about yesterday regarding the departing House Speaker Paul Ryan and his really lame excuse or reason for not seeking another term.
Want to be a father to my children.
But more specifically, he said he didn't want his teenaged kids to only know him as a weekend dad. Well, if you look at the calendar and do the math, you can see that is bullshit, okay?
Has that ship sailed, Scott?
Well, listen, the average House member pocketed $174,000 for showing up to the office 145 out of 261 work days in 2017. They typically don't start their work week until Tuesday, and then they usually head back to the home turf on Thursday afternoon. And then there's also the numerous 10-day or 2-week-long recess periods that they enjoy throughout the year. So, and besides, like you said yesterday, if your kids are teenage, the last thing they want is dad moping around, you know? Good God. But anyway, that's not the topic that I wanted to address
well,
today.
Well, no, but I appreciate you doing the ciphering on that, because you know how it's not like he's, you know, what is it, 16 miles on the Erie Canal and sitting there with standing there with the tow rope in his teeth, okay?
Right.
He lives in a 5,000 plus square foot mansion in Janesville, Wisconsin. He doesn't have to sweat plane fare. I imagine you can use campaign funds for going back and forth.
I think the speaker gets special privileges in terms of travel allowances.
I would not be at all surprised. Of course, he makes more than the average Congress critter for speakifying.
Yeah,
he absolutely does.
Plus, he has that great view of the National Mall in the Speaker's office, if you've ever seen pictures of that, with a little balcony where Boehner used to go smoke. And speaking of that fucker, Boehner...
I knew you were going there the minute you said his name.
That son of a bitch, the other day came out saying he is... I don't know the exact quote, but it was along the lines of...
His view has evolved.
Yeah, his view has evolved on medical marijuana. Well, you motherfucker, now you got me, Bob. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
But you've got to adopt an attitude of Christian charity here, Scott. You know, we welcome the sinner whenever they come to the cross, or the bong, but. The fact of the matter is, he was asked, the reason he evolved is because he was asked to sit on the board of one of the leading marijuana producing companies, cannabis producing companies, in the United States. And, you know, those aren't volunteer boards. Those aren't boards that you just sit on because you're a nice guy and you care about the issue.
Yeah.
You get paid. And John Boehner gonna get paid. And he was brought onto that board for the purpose of trying to convince some other Republicans.
Yeah. That stuff just pisses me off. But that's not why I called. Earlier you commented sort of a sideways comment about being concerned about the focus being on this whole thing with Trump and the documents and Russia and his legal paperwork and stuff like that. Don't worry a whit about that, Bob. Back in 74, now this, you got to remember, this is the year after the summer of Watergate, when we had those long hearings from the Senate Special Committee on Watergate in the summer of 73, and then the calendar flips over and it's 74. Well, by that time, I was working as a pickup and delivery rep for a film processing company. Hands up, who remembers film processing? And my route would take me up through Falls Church, Leesburg, Berryville, Winchester, and then into the panhandle of West Virginia, Martinstown, whatever that little town
Martinsburg,
was.
Martinsburg, yeah, it ain't so little anymore.
And then up to Hagerstown, Maryland, and then down to Frederick, and then down to Gaithersburg, back around the Beltway to Falls Church, and then back to home base in Alexandria. That was a hell of a drive 5 days a week, but I loved it because the little Chevy Nova was equipped with an AM radio. And at that time, 74, when Watergate continued, I had the luxury of listening to a talk station called WLMD, AM 900, situated in beautiful Laurel, Maryland, midway between D.C. and Baltimore, and they used to show up regularly in the Arbitron ratings.
And I'll be darned, you said LMD and you said Laurel, Maryland, so the LMD stands for Laurel, Maryland. I thought it stood for Let's Make Dirty.
But anyway, and they had a rather liberal bent in terms of the hosts. And it was a refreshing thing to listen to it because the topic of the conversation day in and day out was Nixon and Watergate and what might happen next. So, you know, don't be afeard of the topic, because we're living in historic times. I mean, there toward that last week, the late July going into early August of 74, a lot of us literally expected tanks to be rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue before it was all over.
Yeah, you thought Tricky Dick was just going to go completely nuts and maybe start machine gunning people in the streets, or that maybe, you know, Hank the K would give him that advice.
Well, he would be like Al Pacino in Scarface. Say hello to my little friend, you know. Who knows? We didn't know where it was going, but
you know,
again,
you know, that's something for you to work on. You should teach Punky that whenever you say hello to my little friend, he chirps. But go ahead.
Okay. Well, actually, don't say that, because he has been rather vocal all afternoon, and I finally got him to quiet down a little bit.
Just long enough to make a phone call.
You know that nitrous oxide does have a quieting effect on birds? I never knew that. But anyway, here's the topic of today. Thank you, Punk. That I wanted. You missed your cues. Are those my cues? Yes. Pull them out of the cellophane before they scorch. But anyway, you were asking about serving a subpoena for perhaps hidden documents, legal documents, at the White House. And I'm thinking the mechanism to make that happen could turn out to be the ultimate get-even for Jeff Sessions, who I think everybody will agree has been horribly mistreated by Mr. Trump, okay?
So yeah, if it was anybody but Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions III, I might even feel bad about it.
Yeah. But let's say he decides, fuck it. I'm tired of this orange motherfucker for being a nasty son of a bitch toward me and anybody else who doesn't march in line behind him. Let's say Jeff Sessions would be the one to present the search warrant to Trump himself, with FBI agents outside the White House gate ready to be buzzed in. Would that work? Because you're not going to slough off a search warrant handed to you in person by the fucking attorney general, the supposed highest legal officer in the land.
Well, actually, but within that purview, he can fire him. So he could be standing there and say, I have a search, you're fired.
Well, isn't the mechanism which stands up in court that you reach in your pocket, you hand it to him, and once the person either takes it or you even drop it at their feet.
It touches him, yeah.
They're considered served. Isn't that how it works?
Yeah, but then somebody has to actually do the searching. And you would think the process would just run like it would anybody else's house, but most people don't have heavily armed guards standing around the house.
Yeah, but once he's served, he needs to get with his lawyer post haste and yield to the terms of the warrant, because to not do that, wouldn't that become an impeachable offense?
Only if the Congress is willing to act on it. And I'm standing by my position that this Congress would not impeach Donald Trump. I don't care what that Representative X said. This Congress, with its Republican majority, would not impeach Donald Trump if they caught him shooting children from the White House window.
Well, I don't know. If it was Peter King or whoever Congressman X is, if he's even half right in terms of the sense of the members of the House, the Republican members, I would think that they'd want to be rid of this guy come November. Who's to say if things could devolve to that point where Trump is actually served a subpoena, whether he might do a maybe he's waiting for an excuse to say, oh, fuck it, and go back to living in Trump Tower after his sentence has been served. I mean, if I were he, I just, by now, I would have had it.
For the sake of argument, you need 27. There are 237 Republicans in the House and 193 Democrats and five vacancies. You need, to reach that 50% plus one threshold, seven makes 200. So then you need half of 37, which is half of 38. So you need 19 plus 7. You need 26. You need 26 Republicans to join all 193 Democrats and all 193 Democrats acting in concert.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just because I'm such a little ray of sunshine. But I don't, you know, it's the Diogenes thing again. I'm thinking those people don't exist. Because even what Representative X said was predicated on getting past the primary process and if he fires Mueller. There was nothing in there about if Mueller gives us a report showing us he obstructed justice.
Well, no, I'm talking about a warrant to seize the legal documents that Michael Cohen may have stashed at the White House. That's a different chapter of the book, isn't it? That's not the Russia thing. That's about, well, I guess tangentially it is. See, this thing has
gotten... I understand. And Renee in D.C. just said, instead of serving papers by jumping from a shrub, how about serving Dolt 45 by a drone? Legal? No? I think there's a no-fly zone over the White House.
Yeah, there's that. Well, they could stick it in his with the napkins with his Big Mac and fries. I don't know. I just see because a lot of it would depend also on the timing.
Well, I mean, let's go back to my initial premise. It sounds as though you're treating my initial premise as halfway sane. That maybe Michael Cohen has hidden some of this stuff in plain sight with Trump.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you were talking yesterday about, and by the way, the three areas covered by the search warrant were his office, his hotel, and his home.
So they go rooting around in the renovated space.
Yeah, and I hadn't considered. His secret compartments in the floorboards, but see, anything is possible in this whole situation.
That's the whole point. I mean, there's this other, and I imagine this will probably rocket to the top of the stories. People are reading advanced copies of this Comey book, and there's a Sparky just hipped me to it. There's a passage in it where Comey talks about how Trump came to him and said he was thinking about asking him to investigate the PP tape so that he could show that there was no PP tape. You know, the Steele dossier.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, I'm a notorious germaphobe. Of course, there's no PP tape. Well, you know, fuck your germaphobe. He didn't ask him to pee on him. He asked them to pee for him on the bed that Michelle and Barack Obama slept on.
Yeah.
Okay? Which is utterly believable for a psychopath like Trump. But just as when I was talking about Wendy Vitter, Steve said, it sounds to me like she doesn't even know what Brown versus Board of Education is.
Yeah. I hadn't considered that, but reviewing the tape, it starts to make sense.
Well, in this case, there's Trump who isn't sure. What if he's not sure the PP tape doesn't exist? What if he knows what he fucking did while he was over being Dirty Donald in Russia?
Mm-hmm.
And so instead he said, I want this proven to be not true, because I don't want Melania to ever even think there's even a 1% chance that it was true. Well, if there's not a 1% chance it's true and you didn't do it, how come you're talking to the FBI director about it?
Yeah.
He didn't
see
it is, that's the whole thing, Scott. It is true, and he wanted to know if Comey had gotten his hands on it.
Yeah. Well, there are things about this guy. I mean, the most outlandish scenarios any of us could have come up with in the run-up to the, you know, during the primary season and the general election in 2016, we haven't yet begun to unearth things that this guy is capable of, or his minions. And it all goes back to what Mother Trump said at some point: what kind of monster have we produced?
Yeah, well, precisely. And Comey apparently goes where we kind of just did. Writing in the book, he says, in what kind of marriage, to what kind of man, does a spouse conclude there is only a 99% chance her husband didn't do that?
It just boggles the mind what is possibly left to be disclosed about this guy. And you and me and everybody we know tried to warn whoever we could, people away from voting for this asshat. We tried our best to dissuade them from going that way, or conversely, from going a way that would automatically be a vote for Trump, because of the way that they chose to behave on Election Day, November of 2016. And it was entirely avoidable. Everything that we're dancing with today was entirely avoidable. Now, that isn't to say that we would have had a whole different basket full of issues to impede us from making progress in life had the election gone the other way. I'm not saying that at all, because they would have thrown Plan B, the Republicans, would have thrown Plan B into operation, and instead of the black president doesn't deserve to have anything good done, it would be crooked Hillary doesn't deserve to have anything good done. With Trump, they assured themselves that nothing good would get done, at least good in the minds of average everyday people. All manner of good, quote, would get done to benefit the 1%, which is the way they like it. And old Paul Ryan sees, as old Red Fox said, when you can see the handwriting on the wall, you're in the toilet. Well, Paul Ryan saw the handwriting on the wall, and he got while the getting was good. Let me off this ride. I don't like this, you know? But I just...
No, you bought the ticket. You take the ride.
Well, I didn't.
No, but they you did.
Yeah, well...
Meanwhile, there's going to be some questions have to be answered by the Stein... You mentioned getting people to try to avoid this disaster we have. There's going to be... There's trouble in Steiniac land.
Oh, no.
Darlene just sent this along to me.
BuzzFeed, and I was trying to avoid invoking her name.
She has rolled over and cooperated with the Senate Intelligence Committee and disclosed a bunch of documents based upon a request from the Senate Intel Committee. North Carolina Senator Richard Burr confirmed that the Stein campaign had provided documents which the committee requested at the end of last year. Why didn't she tell those fascists to go fuck themselves? I mean, she's Jill fucking Stein, right?
Yeah.
Nope, folded like a cheap suit. When asked at the time what the committee was looking for from the Stein campaign, Burr responded, collusion with the Russians. Speaking to BuzzFeed News, Richard Burr said, we should look at Mike Flynn and not look at her. She became the candidate. She was the one that actually initiated a recount campaign. Where'd that money come from? Millions of dollars. We want to look to see if there's any Russian connections to anything that happened in any campaigns. That's what we were chartered to do.
Now, are they talking to her, or they're just talking about talking to her?
No. They've talked to her, and she's rolled. You know, her campaign's rolled over and collaborated and cooperated.
Oh well, how many tries did she get to take the right plane to the right airport?
Apparently, she didn't have to leave. They just, you know, mailed them in or some such. But I know that. And you know, look, I'm just. But you know, I guess she didn't tell the. She didn't tell the man to stuff it. Oh, well.
Jill can win.
And getting back to Pompeo for a moment, there was one episode where he was asked about a March 2017 briefing, after which Trump told everybody except Pompeo and Dan Coats to leave the room. He's the director of national intelligence. Okay. And according to the Post's reporting, Coats later told associates that Trump had, in that smaller group, asked him to intervene with the then FBI director Comey to get him to back off the investigation of Flynn.
Right.
Okay. So they're asking, Senator Menendez of New Jersey is asking Pompeo about that, and he's given three responses, none of which make a lot of sense. First he said, I'm not going to talk about the conversations with the president that I had, and then later he says, I don't recall what he asked that day precisely, and then he said, he's never asked me to do anything that I consider remotely improper. Well, if he doesn't remember precisely what he asked him that day, then how can he know
that it was or was not improper?
Yeah. Okay. So, and like I told you the other day, the first thing I did when it was obvious that Trump wanted Pompeo for state and this Gina woman for CIA, I sent emails to Kamala Harris and Dianne Feinstein to let them know how much I disapproved of them supporting those two nominees.
Yeah, and I don't think you've got anything to worry about out of those two. I got something to worry about out of Joe Manchin, just like anybody of conscience in whichever Dakota she comes from, North, has to worry about with Heidi crumples like a house of cards height camp.
Yeah. Who's your other senator there in West Virginia?
Oh, Shelley Moore Camel, Capito.
Oh, okay.
Daughter of the single most corrupt politician ever to inhabit an office in the history of the state, Arch Moore.
We've got to get you out here. First of all, you'll like the weather better. And you'll have a city, state, and national government representation.
Oh, I ever hit the lottery, I'm moving to Marin County. That's all there is to it.
Oh, no. Come on down to San Diego. Meet Punky and Chirps and me, and I'll take you out for one of our world-famous, delicious, refreshing, organically grown...
Somewhere in or near San Diego, there's a Mexican restaurant that actually has pulque brought in. And that you know, guts notwithstanding, that's on my list of things I must try at least once.
Okay, now I'm not familiar with that delicacy.
Well, you know, you make tequila out of the agave plant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the agave plant yields a sweet syrup, which the ancient Mexica and other cultures would ferment. and it's kind of snotty and sticky and thick. But
oh well, that's a definition of Donald Trump: snotty, sticky, and thick.
But it's also
a cowbell. Come on, you get awfully damn stingy with those fucking cowbells.
All right, all right.
Go ahead.
But no, that was well played. But it's one of the world's great fermented beverages, and I just want to try it. And there's like one restaurant somewhere in the San Diego area that has it brought north every day.
Well, if we can get that syrupy stuff, because our world famous delicious, refreshing, organically grown snow cones are not to be beaten. Okay,
you are they cruel? But now wait a minute. Are they cruelty free snow cones, Scott?
Oh yes.
Okay.
Yes, they're cage free.
Made from free range snow.
Yeah. Squirt some of that, whatever you call it, onto that snow cone, and baby, you're having yourself a treat.
Woo, party!
And then we can get on the old 1920s wooden roller coaster at Mission
Beach.
No,
we couldn't. No, we couldn't. I don't ride.
Oh, that's right.
I don't do that.
That's unusual. An adventurous lad like yourself.
Nope, don't do roller coasters, and no one's convinced me to go down one of these damn whitewater rivers around here. I like hiking around and scrambling around on rocks and stuff like that, but no, I ain't getting no.
What is your hang up with roller coasters?
They scare the shit out of me. They make me go fast and think I'm going to die. If I want to do that, if I want to do that, I'll go out on the highway and drive fast. At least I'm in charge.
I would never have thought that, Bob, about you. I said the things you learn on this show as a listener, I'm telling you. I would have thought that you would stand in line to ride a roller coaster.
Oh, hell no. That's Agnes. She'll ride them till she pukes.
Yeah, well, that's the only way to do it.
And having said that, it's probably a good idea that I close the program now, Scott.
Okay. Well, anyway,
it's that time.
That's my little contribution. And thank you, Punky, for being quiet. I surely appreciate that, because he was shrieking his little birdie guts out earlier.
That's why you didn't call. Or was that while you were on hold?
No, it was earlier this afternoon. He started out okay with singing and chirping and whistling, and he even meowed once. Because he can meow, and he can say, "Here, kitty, kitty." But he was doing all the sweet stuff, and then he took a notion to break bad and shriek his little guts out. So,
freestyling, was he? Just like Trump.
Oh, God. He's worse than Trump.
Scott, have a good night.
Okay, Bob, good night.
Later. That's our buddy Scott calling from down San Diego way. That was fun. Two past the hour, we closed the program with $184 to finish fundraising for the week, so I guess we'll have $184 to raise on Friday on the front porch. Thanks, everybody, for joining in. Thank you for sharing your precious finite time, whether you listen live in real time or listen via the podcast. Thank you. And, you know, I know a lot of people just turn the program off when I start doing the credits, but I hope people really do hear me thank them for sharing in this conversation, because it does mean a great deal to me. The interaction, the responses are inspiring and motivating. And so thank you all. And thank you all of you who support the program. Thank you to our partial sponsors of the program this evening, our subscribers. Thank you, Charlene, for getting us started. Thank you very kindly to Keith and to Frank and to Jason. Thank you very kindly indeed. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff in the chat room. Thanks to our moderators, Sparky and Steve from Georgistan. Thanks to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you, John Fox, down in Australia with HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, wherever and however it may be. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. They were leading by the way, just so you can know, they were leading a hearing tonight against the further trashing of yet another mountain in southern West Virginia. When I tell you they're the bravest, hardest working people I know, that's not hyperbole. It's a fact. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later.